Well, it's good to see everybody here this morning. We've gone through a change in the last few weeks as my little baby boy, who I just never imagined growing up, he's still not grown up in my mind, went to his first day of preschool. That was a big deal for him. It was a big deal for all of us. You know, when Sterling was a baby, I really didn't think a whole lot about the future of boys in our country. But as I am now in the thick of raising a tried and true cowboy boot clad little worker boy, I'm realizing there's a lot of work that's left to do. Sterling's a very good little boy, but that is not always the case as little boys grow up and become men. One writer put it really well when describing the problem in a book called Raising Confident Boys. Elizabeth Hartley Brewer writes, "Boys are in the news as having a hard time at the moment. They seem to be struggling, finding it harder and harder to succeed, conform, and find a comfortable role in life. Statistics tell us that boys experience more behavioral problems, get involved in more crime, and at a younger age, are losing the academic edge, and demonstrate their despair in significantly higher suicide rates than girls. Social, economic, and even educational changes seem to be undermining their essential manhood. And some see the future as promising little but constant pressure or failure or both. Their self-esteem and motivation appear to be at rock bottom. Boys, however, are half our future," she goes on to write. "Given the changes taking place in society, particularly in employment and the family, growing boys will naturally feel confused and uncertain about the future. For instance, what does fatherhood mean? How important are commitment and marriage? How should they manage their sometimes contradictory feelings of sadness, anger, tenderness, competitiveness, and protectiveness?" And it does scare me to raise a boy. Not quite as much as it scares me to raise two girls, but it does scare me to raise a boy. It scares me thinking about, when I look at our culture and just what we find of our culture, that boys really are, according to this writer, having a hard time right now. When you think about the way that boys play a role in a lot of the most horrible atrocities that are occurring on the face of this earth, where it's boys that are filling the ranks of gangs, where it's boys keeping our prisons well populated. It is boys that are joining up terrorist groups and destroying other human beings senselessly. It's boys, boys, boys. And I'm supposed to raise one of these. This is not a new problem, though. It's not a new problem. If you can read in the Bible, you can see that boys have always had a real rough time finding their manhood as it fits God's will. From the very beginning, in Genesis chapter 4, you find that a boy had a very hard time coping with his low self-esteem. A man named Cain tried to offer something to God that was not accepted. His brother Abel offered something that was accepted. Rather than resolving the problems in his own life, dealing with the self-esteem problem that was facing him, facing himself, he took out his anger and frustration on his brother. And it was a boy who committed the first murder. The stories of Isaac, Jacob, Esau, even the greats like Abraham, Noah, and Moses, they're filled with examples of disregard for honor, disrespect for authority, self-will, self-righteousness, and a poor attitude toward God. You think of stories like Saul, King Saul, the first king of Israel, and his many, many failures as a man. I want to look at one thing out of Saul's life real quickly. If you go to 1 Samuel chapter 9 and verse 21, you notice that Saul was a man who appeared to have a great deal of humility. You read later on in chapter 10 of 1 Samuel in verses 21 and 22 that when it came time to anoint him as king, where was Saul? God announced to the people that there's your king hiding in the baggage. He's hiding amongst the luggage. Now, some people look at that and say, look at the humility of Saul. What a humble man he was. Oh, Saul was so humble, he didn't want the throne for himself because he was so humble. And yet, I think that there's more evidence in the scriptures to show that it wasn't that Saul was humble, it's that Saul didn't want to take responsibility. His biggest problem was self-esteem. His biggest problem was always having an inferiority complex. Even though he was head and shoulders taller than everybody else around him, you look at everything else that he did in his life with respect to David, when David was young and when David was made king. You look at everything that he did to the Philistines and his failure to truly deal with them as an enemy. You look at the way he disregarded God's commandment on several occasions, blatantly. And it wasn't a matter of humility with Saul. It was a matter of Saul having bad self-esteem. It's encouraging, though, to remember that just as the problem is not new, the solution is not new also. And the solution has always been there. And there have been good examples of young men who have really been grown up in God and have done really good things and made the right decision. I try not to focus so much on the bad examples because bad examples can discourage us and make us wonder, is it possible? Is it possible to ever grow up and be the kind of man I'm supposed to be? Yes, it is. Peter, James, John, Andrew all prove it. When you think about the disciples of Jesus, most of them lived well into the 60s in the first century. Some of them, like John, lived into the 90s in the first century AD, which means at the very least, John was about 90 years old when he died. When Jesus selected his disciples, when he found them making fishing line over here and putting nets together and working a tax office over here, when he found his disciples, most of these guys were 20 or 30 year old men. You ever think about that? Jesus himself at the beginning of his ministry was only 30. Jesus was younger than me when he started his ministry. Peter, Andrew, James, John were all probably younger than me. Saul of Tarsus as well was likely younger than me when he met Jesus on the road to Damascus and made the choice to give himself over to Jesus, heart and soul, for the rest of his life. Yes, there are a lot of good examples of young men in the Bible who show us that it can be done. Of course, one of the greatest obstacles to helping young men deal with this problem is that our society sees any moment of weakness, any act of tenderness, as being something that's less than desirable. We teach our young men by example in our culture and our media that they are not allowed to be sensitive, that they're not allowed to be tender, that they're not allowed to cry about things. Here's the problem. When you tell a boy that he's not allowed to cry, he's going to cry about something eventually. There's no getting away from it. That's reality. When you tell a man he's not allowed to cry, eventually he's going to cry about something. But we bottle it up and bottle it up and bottle it up so that when we do cry, it's often at the most inappropriate moments. We cry about things that really don't matter. Because eventually we reach a breaking point. We reach a tipping point. I like the way that Paul said it. When he wrote in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, when he's talking about weakness, rather than fitting the preconception that a man is not supposed to be weak, that a boy is not supposed to be weak, what does Paul say about weaknesses here? In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 9 and 10, he says, "Most gladly, I would rather boast about my weaknesses, that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Now, I'm not talking about being a weenie or anything like that. That's not at all what I'm intimating. But there is nothing wrong with a man being tender. There's nothing wrong with a man being sensitive. There's nothing wrong with a man being thoughtful, thinking about what he says before he says it, rather than being impetuous and brash all the time. But boy, we teach our kids all the time that if they want to grow up and be men, they've got to act a certain way. And our culture is dead wrong about it, my friends. And it's killing our boys. So when I talk to my son about things, when I compliment him about certain things in his life, What are some things that I should tell him to make him feel good about himself? Because self-esteem is a really big deal. And I think the example of Saul, King Saul, that is, proves it. That a man who has a poor sense of self-esteem is going to go through life compensating in ways that are wholly inappropriate. He's going to destroy other people that he feels threatened by. Rather than embracing a man like David and welcoming him into his home as an asset, he saw David as an enemy, where David has killed his tens of thousands and I've only killed my thousands. Therefore, I should pin him to the wall. That was self-esteem. So what should I tell my son when I'm trying to build up his self-esteem in the right way? You know, let's remember something. Whoops. Try to keep compliments specific. Try to keep compliments specific and meaningful given a situation. There are many things that we can say to our young men, as well as our young women, of course, to help bolster their confidence. They need to be praised for their skills. They need to be praised for their good choices. They need to be praised for their wise decisions and their wise ideas, their problem solving, their kind and generous social skills. When we see our boys doing something right, we need to tell them that. We need to call them out for the things that they are doing right, not always just the things that they're doing wrong. And I have to catch myself all the time. This kid of mine is 4 years old and he drives me up the wall. He drives me up the wall. And I understand now why my dad used to say, I just want to skin you and put you as a trophy on the wall. I get it now. I understand it. Rather than always just being frustrated by, stop doing that, quit picking on your sister, get in the car, do it right, go over here, put this away. Rather than focusing on what is wrong, I need to make sure that I'm also building up what is right and telling my son when he is doing the right things and making the right decisions about things. Because he's a sweet little boy. He's a sweet little boy, and I will kill everything that makes him wonderful and good if I do not build up that which is wonderful and good in him. But the thing about it is, we need to compliment more than just things that they accomplish in life. It's not just about telling them they're doing a good job on the soccer field. It's not just about taking them to the Red Robin after they get an A on a test. It's not just about giving them praise for their achievements and their accomplishments in a superficial, earthly way. Because that confidence only takes you so far in life. We also need to make sure that we are complimenting them on the really meaningful things. The soul, the spirit, their worship, their faith, their prayers that they offer. I'm reminded in Philippians chapter 3 and verse 3, it says, put no confidence in the flesh. That's a really good thing to remember. 2 Corinthians 10 verse 17, but he who boasts, let him boast in the Lord. If we're going to try and instill confidence in our boys, it's not just that we need to teach them to do well on the field. It's not just that we need to teach them to do well in school. All things that we should encourage them in, of course, but that's not where real confidence comes. And that is not the kind of confidence that's going to get them to heaven. That's not the kind of confidence that's going to make them leaders in the church someday. That's not the kind of confidence that's going to make them really good husbands and really good fathers. We need to instill confidence in their soul as well. Couple of scriptures to remember here. In Psalm 138 verse 3, notice what the writer says in Psalm 138 verse 3, thou didst make me bold with strength in my soul. I like that. Proverbs 28 verse 1, the wicked flee when no one is pursuing. Of course, that's a whole sermon by itself, isn't it? The fear that wicked people have to live with. Always looking over their shoulder, wondering when the heat's going to come. But let's look at the second half. But the righteous are as bold as a lion. That's a cool verse, isn't it? You can teach your kid how to make varsity, and you can praise him when he's captain of the football team, and you can put a bunch of pins on his sash when he learns how to make fire in the woods with the Boy Scouts. But when you teach your son to be a righteous man, he will live his life as bold as a lion. And there's nothing he'll be afraid of. Acts chapter 4, verse 29. Lord, says the apostles, take note of their threats and grant that thy bondservants may speak thy word with all confidence. Now, I don't know if Peter and James and John knew how to make fire in the forest, and I don't know if they were any good at football. But Peter and James and John were real good preachers of the word. And their confidence didn't come in their ability to speak. And their confidence didn't come in how nice their suit fit them. And their confidence didn't come in their diction. Their confidence didn't come in their vocabulary. No, their confidence came because it came as a result of God. God who filled their soul and filled their spirit with something that is otherworldly. It can actually be quite liberating for our boys to learn this fact. It can be very liberating for our boys to learn that their value does not come from making varsity, and that their value does not come from achieving things in the military, and that their value does not come from being a straight-A student, a valedictorian. Those are all great things. I'm not saying discourage them in those regards, but our boys need to know that they are valuable not because of earthly achievements, but because God has imbued them with an otherworldly kind of value. They are valuable because God values them. They are valuable because God so loved them that He gave His only begotten Son that they might have the opportunity to be saved. That's how valuable they are. They are so valuable that they are worth the blood of Jesus Christ spilled on the ground, dying on a cross. They are valuable because God makes them valuable. And we can never, ever teach them that their value is derived from earthly accomplishments. You know how liberating that must be for a little boy to learn that? You know how liberating it must be to know that if he doesn't make the team, and if he doesn't score the goal, and if he doesn't get an A+ on a test, to know that he is still loved and cherished and valued above all other things on this planet. You know how liberating that must be for him. You know the crazy thing is, when you take pressure off of people, oftentimes that's when they achieve their best. When you take the pressure off of people, that's when they learn to be creative. When you take the pressure off of people, that's when they stop making mistakes. It's when you put pressure on your kids, when they're at the free throw line and you're the dad on the stands yelling, "Make it, you black hole of a boy!" Now, that's not my dad, by the way, but there was a father when we used to play basketball. Boy, he was an awful guy. He followed us everywhere, too. His son was on every team with my older brother, like going up through, you know, middle school and everything. And he used to yell at his son that he was a black hole every time the kid passed the ball to him. You think that kid's ever going to make a free throw? Ever? No, it's quite liberating for our boys to know that their value comes from something other than menial earthly accomplishments. And that's all they are. I don't care if you become president someday, Sterling. You are still valuable in my eyes. He's still valuable in my eyes. We must teach our boys that lesson. Otherwise, we feed them three dangerous ingredients in their upbringing. I'll tell you what these ingredients are. The first one is isolation. When you feed your kid a steady diet that he's all by himself, that he has nobody to turn to, that he has nobody who cares about him. When you feed your kid a steady diet of insecurity, that no matter what he does, he's never going to make you proud. That no matter what he does, he's never going to do it right. When you feed your kid a steady diet of insignificance, that no matter what he does, he doesn't mean anything. That every act of kindness that he does is forgotten. That every small amount of charity is worthless. That every little spider that he wants to take outside instead of squishing under his shoe is pointless. When you teach your kid that he's insignificant, when you teach your kid that he's insecure, when you teach your kid that he's isolated, you will fulfill every dream and desire that Satan has in his gnarly little mind. It is, after all, Satan's main goal for us to feel this way. Notice in Isaiah 59, go to the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament, and notice in Isaiah 59, verses 1 and 2, "Behold, the Lord's hand is not so short that it cannot save, neither is his ear so dull that it cannot hear. But your iniquities have made a separation between you and your God. Your sins have hidden his face from you so that he does not hear. For your hands are defiled with blood, your fingers with iniquity, your lips have spoken falsehood, your tongue mutters wickedness. That is Satan's goal, isn't it? To get you separated, to get you isolated, to make you feel worthless and insecure and pointless and meaningless. That's Satan's goal. To insert sin into your life so that you are alone. And when you teach your boy that, you've just done Satan's work for him. It nearly worked with a lot of people in the Bible. It worked with quite a few, by the way. It nearly worked with Elijah. Elijah found himself at the point in 1 Kings chapter 19 that he wanted to die. He felt like he was alone in the world. "For I alone am left," he says to God. He felt isolated, insecure, and insignificant. It worked with Judas, didn't it? Judas did what he did to Jesus. And by the time the sun rose the next day, he was a dead man hanging from a tree. Because Satan made him feel insignificant, insecure, and isolated, like there was no backing out. It worked with King Saul. It worked with King Saul. By the end of King Saul's life, bleeding on a battlefield, he had nothing else to live for. His son was dead, his army defeated, and another man was about to sit on his throne. He had nothing left to live for. It nearly worked with Jeremiah. It nearly worked with Job. We need to remind our boys that they are not alone. Absolutely not alone. Romans 8, verse 31. So many applications, right? God is for us. God is with us. And if God is for us, who can be against us? They are significant to a lot of people. Our boys need to know that they're significant. And our boys need to know that what they do with their lives matters. What's the big deal? How I spend my life doesn't affect anybody else. What I do doesn't mean anything to anybody. If I want to waste my life doing this or that, who cares? Nobody cares about me anyway. A lot of people care. A lot of people have invested themselves in your future. You think about that? A lot of people have invested themselves in your future. You are quite significant. And you're quite valuable. Remember John 3 verse 16, like we already alluded to. You know how valuable you are? You're so valuable that God died on a cross through His Son Jesus Christ. You're so valuable that Jesus Christ willingly gave Himself so that you could have life. The writer from the book that we quoted earlier says a really great phrase. She says, "After all, presence are no substitute for our presence." Nice little play on words there. So whether we're parents or coaches or counselors or a preacher or an elder or just somebody that our boys look up to in the community, our boys need our support and our companionship. They don't need our stuff. "I can work 70 hours a week and make a whole bunch of money, and the reason is I got to afford that speedboat so we can take the kids on the lake. I got to work 70 hours a week so that we can afford a great big vacation." So you're saying you're going to sacrifice 51 weeks so that you can spend that 1 week on vacation with your kids. Guess what? Your kids don't want a big house. I know. Boys are ridiculous. They go through the toy section. "I want it. I want it. That's my favorite." You don't even know what it does. Sterling's favorite toy is whatever toy is in front of his face at the moment. Thank you. They act like they want a speedboat. They act like they want a jet ski. They act like they want to go on a big vacation. They act like they want to have a giant house. I get it. From a superficial point of view, that's what our kids want. I get it. But you know what our kids want more than anything else? And they'll never say it, but you can see it in the look in their eyes when you actually do spend quality time with them. What your kids want is you. That's what they want, is you. Sterling wouldn't care anything about a truckload of toys if I sat down with him with a few blocks and built something on the floor. We went running yesterday. That's all he wanted. He didn't want something that cost $1 million. I got home from my run yesterday morning, all sweaty and tired, ready to eat breakfast. And he said, "Daddy, I want to put my shoes on and go running with you." I said, "Well, you know what, son? Let's go running. Then Heidi wanted to go running, and really it was mostly she ran and then walked and then got carried. It's good exercise for me. Our kids want our presence, not our presence. And in many ways, I think this is why some churches decline. This is why families fall apart. This is why kids bring guns to schools and shoot their teachers. This is why kids commit suicide. Because they don't have our presence. They're alone. Now, the previous 2 points, the three dangerous ingredients and presence, not presence, if we fail to live by the 2 previous points, this will be the result. Here's the sad conclusion to the matter. If we do not teach our kids what they need, if we do not show our boys that we value them, if we do not give our boys our presence and our attention and our love and devotion, there is a whole world of predators out there who will give it to them instead. There is a world of predators out there who are more than happy to welcome them into their ranks. When our boys feel isolated and insecure, they seek comfort with the thugs and the miscreants of the world. Let me give you some statistics to think about here. As far as what our boys are facing from the world, it is estimated that there are over 1 million gang members in our country. And 40% of them are younger than 18 years old. There's a show called Drugs, Inc. I think it's on the Nat Geo channel. Really interesting show. It's a weekly documentary about the drug culture in America. A lot of the episodes tend to focus a lot on gang activity, which is really, you know, the ones trafficking the drugs. And it's interesting when you hear these kind of anonymous, you know, the faces blurred out and the voices distorted. When you hear these interviews with drug traffickers, they all have the same story. Yeah, I got started when I was 12 years old. Older gang members recruited me. I did odd jobs and small things around the gang and worked my way up the power structure. It's all the same story. 10, 11, 12-year-old boys getting recruited by the gangs. And why? Well, I had a broken home. I didn't have a father. Nobody cared about me. I was doing bad in school. And the gang seemed like easy money and social acceptance. It's the same story. It's the same story for all of them. Another statistic here. On average, boys are sexually active before they are 17 years old. 17. Younger than 17, on average, boys are sexually active. And there's plenty of opportunities out there for them to get started. 28% of boys between the ages of 12 and 20 drink alcohol. 28%. That's over a quarter of boys between 12 and 20 years old drink alcohol. In the United States, here's the one that's really shocking for me. In the United States, on average, boys are 11 years old when they view their first pornographic imagery. On purpose, that is. 11 years old when they begin to seek out pornography. And there is a $1 billion industry of pornographers who are more than willing to recruit our young boys into the industry. There's a world of predators out there. And if you don't give your boy attention, they will. If you don't love your boy, they'll seek it somewhere else. There's a world of predators who are more than happy to take your son's life, chew it up, and spit it out. After I watched an episode of Drugs, Inc. the other day, in this interview where they were talking about boys being recruited into gang activity, it was so funny. I just was listening and it dawned on me, that's Proverbs chapter 1. It's Proverbs 1. Notice in Proverbs 1 verse 8, "Hear, my son, your father's instruction. Do not forsake your mother's teaching. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath to your head, ornaments about your neck." But you know what? In order for that to come true, the father and the mother actually have to do some teaching. If you want your kids to follow your teaching, you've actually got to do the teaching. "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, 'Come with us,' let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol, even whole as those who go down to the pit. We shall find all kinds of precious wealth. We shall fill our houses with spoil. Throw in your lot with us. We shall all have one purse. Now, I know that there's no gang member today in Oklahoma City or L.A. who's going to talk like that. But when you look at the content of Proverbs chapter 1, that is exactly what's going on. It's the exact offer being made. Throw in your lot with us, you'll be a rich man. It's easy money. It's social acceptance. It's being a part of the strong while preying on the weak. That's the offer of every predator. And by the end of this context, he goes on to say in the last couple verses there, they lie in wait for their own blood. They ambush their own lives in verse 18. So are the ways of everyone who gains by violence. It takes away the life of its possessors. There are two paths then. Two paths. Our sons are either going to learn life from us, or they're going to learn death from the world. There's no middle ground. No getting away with it. We'll bring the lesson to a close there. And I want to encourage you. I know this lesson is kind of geared at the boys. I understand that. There's a lot of things that we need to talk about with our girls too. And I'll be working up a lesson here in the coming months that's going to focus more on dealing with the girls. So like I said, I've got two of them that I have to do something with here in the next 18 years. But you know what? Whether you're a boy or a girl, man or woman, adult or child, we all have the same need, don't we? The need to be reconciled to our God. Sin is a great separation, like Isaiah 59 puts it. It is a great separation. We are separated from our God because of it. Jesus Christ came so that he could bridge the gap. He could be the mediator between God and man. He could be the thing that reconnects us with our Maker, our Creator. He's our Savior. If you've not been living the way that you should, if you have been living by the flesh, if you've been living by your own will, your own wisdom, selfishness, now is an opportunity for you to put all that behind you. Live the life that God intends for you. The life that God has set up for you through His gospel. It is good news after all. And who's going to reject the message of he who believes and is baptized shall be saved? So whatever need you might have, I encourage you to please come forward as we stand and sing.